Welcome to Book Club Appetizer, the snackable podcast that's perfect for kicking off book club meetings or enhancing your solo reading adventures.
We are your book crazy hosts. I'm Emma.
And I'm Abby. We're here to make hosting book club easy. We pick titles that will foster discussion and debate. Then we bring the author into the studio for an exclusive interview.
And anybody who has a book club knows, after you pick the book, the most important thing is what you want to eat and drink while you talk about the plot. So every month, we pair our books with an appropriate appetizer and cocktail recipe taken from recently published cookbooks that we love.
The novel we read this month is a thriller with characters you're not sure you can trust. And part of the story takes place in an abandoned prison in Philadelphia, Eastern State Penitentiary.
The cocktail we're sipping on is a take on a Blackberry Ricky that the bartenders at David Burke's Kitchen made for a party hosted to celebrate the publication of the book. It's got vodka, Prosecco, lime juice, and muddled blackberries, which gives the drink a very ominous feel.
And Emma and I know they are delicious because we were at this party.
Humble brag, regular brag.
For our appetizer, we were inspired by one of the characters in this month's read, who's a chef and makes decadent wood-fired pizzas topped with mouth-watering combinations. Taking a page from his book, we turn to The Kitchen Cookbook, recipes, kitchens, and tips to inspire your cooking, for their recipe for margarita pizza and beyond. The Kitchen, which is Apartment Therapy's cooking site, was started by food writer Sarah Kate Gillingham and shaped by executive editor Faith Durand. They passed on their recipes for pizza dough and fresh tomato pizza sauce, as well as a half a dozen pizza topping ideas. Or you can, of course, take your lead from the delicious-sounding pizzas in the novel. All of those recipes are on readitforward.com/podcast, and the best part is, no wood-fired oven required.
So before we introduce this month's read, recap the plot, and invite the author into the studio, we have to warn you. As always, this podcast contains plot spoilers.
This month, we read Long Black Veil by Jennifer Finney Boylan, which opens in August of 1980 in Philadelphia and centers on six friends from college. As the book begins, they are slightly hungover from a wedding the previous night. Casey, a portly, easygoing guy, is the groom, and his bride, the sarcastic Whaler, who was raised in Ireland.
Also in attendance are the brooding Quentin, art-obsessed Rachel, who happens to be in love with Quentin, preppy Tripper, talented musician Maisie and her younger brother Benny, and Quentin's former professor, Herr Crystal. These friends are just about 2 months post-college graduation, without any solid plans ahead, and they've just spent the morning at the Philadelphia Art Museum, gazing at Cézanne's The Large Bathers. As they walk, they come to the now-abandoned prison, Eastern State Penitentiary, which opened in 1829 and, at the start of the novel, has been closed already for 8 long years.
And this is a real place, and I can tell you, it's scary.
Creepy in real life.
Definitely.
Creepy in the book.
So, of course, this merry band of misfits decides to go inside the prison to check it out, which is really dumb. And as soon as they do, young Benny takes off after a stray cat.
Never split up.
Never split up. Stay together.
In the creepy state penitentiary.
So as the group follows Benny, the temperature drops in cell block 1. And when they try to leave, they find themselves locked inside a chain and a padlock across the door that they entered through. And they aren't alone.
Eek. With a setup like that, I probably don't even have to say this, but the night ends in tragedy. Many years later, one of the group, Casey, who is now a big-time celebrity chef, is charged with murder after a skull is uncovered at Eastern State. There's only one person who can prove that Casey is innocent, but that person is reluctant to come forward, for in revealing Casey's innocence, it would also unravel a whole world of secrets that this character has built.
The novel jumps back and forth in time from the happenings of that sticky August day in 1980 to present day. We also meet Judith Kerrigan, who is living a satisfying life in Maine with her husband and son, but she's somehow connected to the events in Philadelphia over 20 years ago. As the accusations against Casey ramp up, she finds herself unwillingly drawn back into the drama.
Beyond the intensely atmospheric thriller at the center of the story, it's also a story of identity, of loyalty, of secrets, and love. Long Black Veil asks important questions about sacrificing for those we care about at the risk of our own happiness, and about the price of cleaving a life in two, to the before and the after. How can that affect someone and eat away at who they are and what they believe?
Jennifer Finney Boylan is a masterful writer. She is the best-selling author of 14 books, and Long Black Veil marks her triumphant return to fiction. What I loved about her storytelling is that the reader can figure out the crux of the mystery, but it keeps unfolding to the characters, and the result is absolutely riveting. Emma, what was your favorite part?
I love the way that Jenny grounds her characters in their cultural interests. There are so many really nuanced references to art, to literature, to popular music, both of the 1980s and the present day, and getting a sense of what the characters like gives you a sense of who they are as real and rounded people.
Yeah, there is just so much to unpack in this literary mystery. It's truly like peeling back the layers of an onion. But some questions can only be answered by the author. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Long Black Veil author Jennifer Finney Boylan in the studio right after this brief message.
This episode of Book Club Appetizer is brought to you by Paper Cuts, Read It Forward's video channel on YouTube. Paper Cuts is all about having fun with books and celebrating them in true book nerd fashion. Every Thursday, we're bringing you book recommendations, games, and quizzes featuring our favorite reads and authors. Abby and I even star in our own series, Six Picks, where we recommend books all based around a particular topic. Check us out at youtube.com/papercutsvideo.
And now we welcome Jennifer Finney Boylan, author of Long Black Veil, into the studio.
Thank you so much for being here, Jenny, on Book Club Appetizer. It's great to get to talk about this book, Long Black Veil.
Long Black Veil.
Yes.
A literary thriller, a page-turner, and a book which I hope has more than a few of the ideas that I'm probably best known for talking about, namely identity and gender and mystery.
Yeah. So what urged you to write a thriller?
Well, I tell you what, this the first chapter of this book is set in a real place, the broken down ruins of a former prison, Eastern State Pen, which is right there in the heart of Philadelphia. And during the time that the book is set, at least the first chapter, it was just the city didn't know what to do with it. So our heroes, of course, are messing around in it. Six recent college graduates, and they get themselves locked in, and then they just as quickly find that behind those walls they are not alone. So that's where we begin. But I got the idea when I visited Eastern State Penitentiary, which is now an historical site, an archaeological museum, and 3 months out of the year, apparently, the world's largest haunted house. Seriously, this is how they raise their money. They turn the whole thing into the haunted mansion for 2 or 3 months every year. Anyway, I wasn't there then, but I was walking around, and it looks like it is completely out of a Hollywood movie set. It is the creepiest. I mean, imagine this. Here's a broken down prison from the 18th century. Long, long hallways, roof fallen in, some of the cells, many of the cells still have beds in them. The whole thing is just a spectacular ruin. And so as I walked around there, I started thinking about, well, for one, what a cool setting it was. And I was thinking about how that place could yield a really cool story. But I also started thinking about the ways people find themselves imprisoned, not only in the obvious way, but also in the other little jails that we build for ourselves. And as a transgender woman, and as, you know, a person in the LGBTQ movement, I know lots of people who have been shackled by the inability to live their truth out loud. But it's not just LGBT people either. I mean, I really think that the world is full of people who cannot quite be themselves because, for a lot of reasons, but mostly because they're afraid or because other people pose a threat to them if they live their truth. So that's what gave me the idea. I was walking around this place and I suddenly thought, you know, there's a lot of prisons in the world.
Yeah. And what was challenging about writing a thriller? Did you know sort of where the arc was headed when you started, or did it sort of surprise you as you wrote it?
Well, that is the trick. And in writing mystery, you do kind of have to know the ending. Either that or you're going to get painted into a corner, or you might be. Usually, I think the best books are the ones that in some way reveal themselves to the writer as the story's being told. And I think that did happen to me. Certainly the characters turned out to be full of all kinds of things I had not expected. But in this case, I wrote the first couple chapters and then I said, all right, we've got to figure this out. So I did have a very clear bullseye I was trying to hit with this one. And that was a change.
Yeah. And so I know you grew up outside of Philadelphia. You know, why did you choose to set part of your story in your hometown?
James Thurber once said, you know, years later, after he'd been living in New York City for decades and decades, that in his dreams, he still heard the ticking of the clocks of Columbus, Ohio, where he was from. And I think the places of our origin always haunt us. And I think, I don't know if I hear the clocks of Philadelphia, but it's certainly the place that I'm always drawn back to. Particularly, I mean, I was also writing about a group of people who, in the summer of 1980, have recently graduated from the same college where I went, which was Wesleyan, and they find themselves kind of back in the towns where they grew up, in the suburbs around Philadelphia. So that's an experience that I had, and it's just a place I know really, really well.
Mm-hmm. And so what research did you do into the history of Eastern State Penitentiary as you were writing?
Well, I did the tour, and then I went back and I had the special tour, which the directors of Eastern State were really, really kind in giving me. And then I bought every book that I could, read every book that I could, and there's also some wonderful videos you can go online and see what this place looks like. I fear I don't really do it justice. It's so insanely creepy, even on a sunny day. You step into this place and immediately the temperature drops like 10 degrees. You can feel it. And, you know, I said to the person who's giving me the tour, is that just because these stone walls are so thick? And she said, well, either that or the ghosts. Right. Okay. This is going to work out just fine.
Exactly. So you talk a lot about this Da Vinci work, St. John the Baptist, and it's actually the cover image, which I think is so evocative. And one of our characters, Rachel, this is her life's work of studying this painting. So what's the significance for you about bringing this work in?
Oh my gosh. Well, how long is this podcast again? All right. So John the Baptist was Da Vinci's last painting, and it shows John the Baptist. I must say, a very sexy looking John the Baptist with his shirt off, and he's got his left hand. His right hand is, his fingers are over his heart, and his left hand, he's kind of pointing up to heaven, and he's looking at you with these wet, sweet, loving, forgiving eyes, and it's the same smile that he gave the Mona Lisa. And it was incredibly controversial at its time, this painting, because John the Baptist was seen as, usually depicted as, this kind of wild-eyed, locust-eating nut. And here's this very androgynous, sexual figure. And there was a complete scandal. This character, Rachel, is obsessed with this painting, in part because it reminds her of a love that she lost, a very... androgynous young man, her boyfriend Quentin, from from college. She paints him kind of in the same attitude. To me, that if you look at the painting, you see a transfigured form. You see a person who is both mortal and human, but also someone who is just kind of, it's like the love of God is like a lightning bolt striking his upraised finger, and he's got this just amazing smile, and he is clear, as you look at him, he's clearly both male and female. And on the cover of the book, the designers used part of this painting, and then they kind of, to emphasize the title Long Black Veil, put this black slash of paint kind of across his face, which disguises him a little bit. And the first thing that happens when people look at this cover is they go, wow, that's really eerie. Wait, is that a man or a woman? And I go, interesting question. So anyway, this question of transfiguration, the way humans are changed into something both mortal and eternal by love, is... an obsession, certainly the character Rachel, who does the painting, certainly of Da Vinci, and I might allow as Hal also an obsession of the author of this book.
So I'm just going to give a warning here to anyone who hasn't read the book. We're going to get into some spoilers here, so go read Long Black Veil and then come back. We'll be waiting. but I can't let the opportunity pass without really delving into some of this deeper stuff at work here. So the narrator in the beginning says, not many men and women have the luxury of dying twice. And we see Quentin sort of saying goodbye to his old life and embracing a new life, which I know is a reality that many trans men and women had to go through. Does that mirror your own story at all, or?
This is a good question. So, yes. Let the record show there is a transgender character in this book. Exactly who it turns out to be and how this person is revealed is part of the fun. So we'll leave that unspoken. But this person does what at one time was considered the protocol for coming out as trans, which is that you were supposed to go somewhere, have your surgery, do the old switcheroo, and then move somewhere where no one knew you and start life over, and under the presumption that no one would know that you were transgender, that you were now, you know, just like anybody else, right? And I can sort of understand the logic behind that. I think the idea being... that, at least at that time in history, being trans was considered such a scandalous identity that no one could live a life full measure bearing that shame. Of course, now it seems insane that people would think of that way. And yet, I can tell you, I still know many, many people who are living in what we call stealth, living in stealth. And no one knows that they are trans, including their spouses. And before people are jumping up and shouting with outrage about how dare they do such a thing, I can only say you must put yourself in the shoes of people who have felt that they had no alternative. And, you know, if you've lived 40 of your years in one gender and, say, 20 before that as the other gender, is it really... I would say it's not a falsehood to hide this identity or to hide your history from someone that you love. But yeah, this used to be the way people had to live in the world. And which, if you think about it, is crazy because it means that you are cut off from your family, from the people you love, in some cases from your children. And you're beginning a life that in some ways has no history. And in fact, you are swapping one secret for another, which, I don't know, when I came out, I found the biggest difference was not going from male to female, but going from a person who had a big secret to a person who didn't have a secret. And that was the thing that, I mean, that was the prison that I got out of. It was really not gender, it was secrecy. And so, for me, the idea that someone in stealth would have a life in which they have to not be able to speak freely about the truth of their past is really sad. And I think it would slowly, you know, gnaw away at someone's heart, as it does for this character.
So one of the things I just love about this book is I wouldn't call this a quote-unquote transgender novel. I would describe a thriller, as a mystery, as captivating, fast-paced. But the plot revolves around, you know, our great beloved transgender character. So, you know, why was it important for you, as you said, I hope not, to really make that distinction and just have this character as one of the others in his group or her group?
I will say that I approach this with a little bit of trepidation because the idea of a person who's in stealth being seen as someone who's not being honest with the people around her is a meme that I'm a little uncomfortable with because it seems to suggest that trans people are somehow being deceitful. And I think that's a thing we have to let go of. Transgender people experience their lives in all sorts of different ways. And there's no one right way. There's no one emblematic way. And we need to accept the fact that there's a huge diversity of experience and that everybody's journey is both different and also worthy of respect and dignity. I was interested in her as a character in a way not so much because she's trans, but because she has fundamental questions to ask that I think are universal, and I think that most readers of this book, I presume, will not be transgender people, but they will find something very familiar in the philosophical dilemma that she finds herself in, namely, what do you owe the friends of your youth? So our heroine, who has lived a kind of quiet life in stealth for most of her life, has a choice in the book, which is when one of her old friends from that hot July day is accused of murder from the events that happened back in 1980, she's the only person who knows that he's innocent. But in order to prove his innocence, she would have to come out and essentially undo the life that she's created. So the questions that are haunting her are questions like, what do we owe the friends of our youth? Are we now the people that we have been? And in any life that has a before and an after, How is it possible to live one life rather than two? I think this question of the persistence of identity is one that we all wrestle with, especially as we get older. So, you know, I'm what am I now? 58 years old. I've lived about a third of my life as a woman now, and yet I did have a boyhood. So what does it mean to be an adult female who had a boyhood? How did I get here from there, as we'd say in Maine? The world is full of people who can't quite draw a line between who they were and who they've become. So you see, you know, those shocked faces of people who are, you know, ex-Marines and former astronauts and ex-nuns and ex-husbands. I mean, the world is full of exes and formers, and yet nobody deserves to be defined by who they were. We all want to be defined by who we are. So there's an old joke about the old New England farmer who says, "I've got a great shovel here. It'll last forever. I've replaced the blade 3 times and the handle 2x. Ha, ha, ha. Great shovel. It'll last forever." So I think we're all like that. We're all like that shovel. As time goes on, so many aspects of us change, and yet something in us remains constant. And what is that if all of our cells change, if our faces change, if our experiences change, if our names change, if our genders change? What remains constant in us? And I would say the thing that remains constant in us is soul, is that undefinable but distinct thing in our hearts that is the source of all love, and that makes us ourselves, whether we're 100 years old or a one-day-old baby.
Yeah, and that's universal throughout all of humanity. So what, if anything, Jenny, in this novel is autobiographical?
I won't try to duplicate the French, but didn't Flaubert say essentially, you know, I'm all the characters, I'm Madame Bovary, I'm, you know. So let's see. Well, that trans woman has a lot of my experience, although I was never in stealth. I mean, I'm one of the most out trans people in the world. So I've never had the experience generally of people not knowing that I was trans. And I do sometimes wish that I knew what that was like. I do wish sometimes I had my privacy and that I could, you know, live a more private life. I mean, it's weird to, you know, you walk into some, you know, restaurant in a strange town and suddenly somebody comes up to you and starts telling their friends, "Oh yeah, and here's someone who knows the most intimate details of my life." And yet, you know, it's no one's fault but mine, you know, because I insisted on writing about these issues. But I tell you what, the when I was a college student, when I was a Wesleyan student, I remember going to the library, and there was like to learn about people like me, and there was nothing about people like me, or worse, there were these books that were just full of lies and these silly, stupid theories that so-called, you know, sex researchers had come up with that were just completely ridiculous. No one said that they were ridiculous because there were no transgender people who were out enough to be able to say, you know, everything you've written in your book is wrong. It reminds me, I used to read these books. Or I saw a cartoon, someone's reading a book, the title of the book is All About You, and the author, not you. So guess what? Now a person could go to the library at Wesleyan or anywhere else and find a book by me. They could find Long Black Veil. They could find She's Not There. They could find I'm Looking Through You. Or they could find other good books by other trans writers like Janet Mock or Kate Bornstein, or many of the hundreds of really good trans writers that are out there now. And because of that, now those young people will know that they are not alone, they are not crazy. And so that's what I've swapped. Now someone can go and not be afraid and know that they exist in the world. And that's what I've traded in for having a sense of privacy. Mm-hmm. So you asked me what was personal or autobiographical in the book. So that experience, I guess, is autobiographical. There's kind of a stoner chef who's a sweet, sweet big guy. He makes some of the same recipes that I make. I've given him all of my recipes. There's kind of a snob guy from the main line. There's a little of me, and I guess, you know, there's a lot of me in all these characters. But I think particularly in the narrator and in her best friend, Casey, people will see someone who might seem a little familiar.
Mm-hmm. And so at what age did you realize, you know, you were a woman? And then from that point, how long did it take you to transition?
It's a better question. At what point did I realize I was a writer?
Yeah, there you go.
The terrible struggle. I fought against it. Finally, I accepted it. I came out. And my friends at first, oh, no, you're a writer? Oh, no, what will we do? But slowly they came to accept me. And now it's like, you know, it's not a big deal. But I can't, you know, ha, 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 okay. You want me to stop? I always knew that there was something weird, there was something wrong about it. It's one of my earliest memories is of not, I remember my mother ironing my father's white shirts on the ironing board and saying, someday you'll wear shirts like this. And me thinking, really? Why would I wear shirts like my father's? Having said that, I want to quickly add that not every trans person knows from the day they're born. Many, many people, their self-awareness comes at a much later age. And again, there's no, I want to bend over backwards if I can to make sure that people don't associate my experience with the you know, the so-called emblematic trans experience, whatever that is. There is no such thing. But for me, it was always something that I knew, although when I was, you know, 4 or 5 years old, I didn't really know the difference between boys and girls. And as I got older and my sense of gender became more sophisticated, then I came to have a more specific idea of what it was that was wrong in my experience of the world. And it's worth saying that, and again, this is just me, I was never a particularly feminine person, either then or now. My desire really had nothing to do with sequins or false eyelashes or stilettos or really, I'm sorry to break your hearts, but I've never particularly cared about being pretty. Sometimes that's fun, you know. And there's sometimes when it's a lot of fun and I celebrate that. But I'm not in love with beauty as a thing. For me, the thing that I yearned for was this body that I'm in now. So, you know, specifically breasts, vagina, clitoris. Can I say all that on a podcast?
Yeah.
It was a very physical, very specific body that felt like I wasn't wired for. And when I woke up after surgery, my sense was, oh, great, okay, now that's done. Now I never have to think about gender again. Ha, 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 ha. Right, so that didn't work out the way I thought. As I'm talking, I know that there might be a lot of trans people listening to this podcast thinking, well, Jenny Boylan, I have exactly nothing in common with you, because I know there are a lot of trans people who don't care about the body stuff, who love the idea of beauty and fashion and, clothes and all that cool stuff. And I love those people, and they are my sisters, and in some cases, my brothers. So I really want to celebrate all of these experiences. But for me, it was about feeling at home in a particular body. And I don't really, you know, I mean, this is why I'm such a failure as a trans spokesmodel. You know, my ideas of womanhood have a lot to do with, being a mother to my children, being a teacher, with being a wife to my wife, I'm not exactly Betty Crocker, but I am, to some degree, I am you know, the soccer mom of the movement, which, you know, might only mean that I'm the most boring transgender person in the public eye. And yet, I think being boring for me is a revolutionary act, because guess what? We trans people are everything. We are models, and we are actresses, and we are airplane pilots and cops and firemen and English teachers and soccer moms and soccer dads. There's a lot of ways of being us, and you know, the more different kinds of trans people we see in the public eye, the better. Yep. So, I don't know. I have no idea what the question was that you asked
me
to begin with.
But amazing.
I'll just, if you want me to keep ranting, believe me, I can just turn this on or off.
Well, to continue a great rant, you know, as an LGBTQ activist, is there anything you'd like to say to the current administration?
Yeah, fuck you. Wait, no, let me try it. Let me try a more modulated approach. What would I say? Do you not know that trans children and trans adolescents are just trying to live their lives, that these are precious, endangered, maligned souls who, rather than scorn, deserve support. They deserve access to health care. They deserve dignity and privacy. And they deserve a little bit of love. In fact, they deserve a lot of love. And actually, and that goes, I said children and adolescents, but that goes for all of us. I think people think that we have come up with the whole idea of our identity in order to hurt people's feelings. What is lacking in this administration and in so many Republican voices is a little human kindness, a little sympathy for the idea that not everyone's experience of being human is the same. I remember when I was young, I had a great aunt who was deaf, and I thought she was really funny, you know, because she was always like looking around, and her hearing aids would squeak and squelch, and she made these guinea pig sounds like whoop 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 whoop, because she would never know what was going on. And I thought she was hilarious. Well, guess what? Now I'm 58 years old, and I've lost most of my hearing, and I wear these elaborate hearing aids, and I live in a very quiet and echoey world sometimes. And now I'm the person who's looking around going, whoop, whoop, whoop. And it wasn't that I didn't understand that there were deaf people in the world when I was young. It's just that I wasn't one of them, so I didn't really give a shit. We all need to have the moral imagination to have compassion for people who are not us, for people whose experience of the world is different from our own. And guess what? You're going to spend most of your life with people who are not you. So this administration, rather than making life worse and harder and more complex for this vulnerable small group of people, how about making our lives a little easier? How about, if you can't make our lives easier, can you not at least leave us alone? There's a Randy Newman song in which he says, "Lord, if you can't take care of us, can't you please, please let us be?" So, you know, there are all sorts of good things you could do for trans people. The Obama administration and others helped move us toward a better future for trans people. If you can't do the good things, can you at least not make things suck more than you have to? There are a lot more pressing issues in this country than where this tiny, vulnerable minority of people go to the bathroom.
So switching gears a little bit.
Oh, good. What am I starting to kind of?
No.
Sweat from my eyeballs.
No,
sorry.
I love it. Okay. But I want to talk about Benny.
I'm shaking my hands in the air like the young Jack Kennedy. We choose to go to the moon and do the other thing, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. Okay, Benny. What do you want to know about Benny?
Benny is one of the most fleshed out characters in this book, and I just loved him.
I'm so glad you do, because, you know, I've spoken about this book a little bit so far, and no one has asked me about him. So this is, we don't know quite exactly what he is. He's on the spectrum somewhere.
Yeah.
And he's the little brother of one of this group of six people who go into Eastern State on that hot summer day. He is a child at the time of what the Irish would call the Troubles, when the disaster happens at Eastern State. And we, as a child, it's clear something is up with him. We meet him again when he's like 50 years old. And he's a man who has never kind of found his way in the world. And yet, he is, he's really super smart. He spouts off the lyrics to Beatles songs in Latin. He builds these many-sided geometric structures in his bedroom out of cardboard. Well, he's certainly a savant. Yet he's also a person who's he's afraid of the world, and he's also the little brother of an older sister who is never quite accepted, who's never quite gotten over not being an only child, and she's. It's funny because the older sister is Maisie, who is a piano teacher and an organ teacher, and she's devoted herself to teaching music to special needs children. And the only child that she won't help is her own brother. And she just says, well, I've helped him enough. And yet, he's always trying to figure out a way of saving himself by saving other people. And I'll leave that phrase just as vague as that. But towards the end of the book, he does a remarkable act of bravery. He does a couple of them, in fact. And he gets his moment to raise his voice.
Yeah, I just think he's so complex and beautiful, and we can all see a little bit of ourselves in him, and I like that it's sort of left undefined, up to the reader's interpretation.
Yeah, the book is full. I mean, really, if you think about it, all of these characters. So there's the six who are in Eastern State. There's the child, so that's seven, and they're also accompanied by their former teacher, Kristal, and each of these people. Are these kind of delightful, loving, goofy people is not quite themselves, and are they're kind of yearning for the lives that they wish that they could create, that they feel is they can almost get their fingers on it. Now and again, they catch a glimpse of the selves that they could be if things had been just slightly different. And those selves are always eluding them. And so what is that? I mean, Langston Hughes famously wrote the poem, What Happens to a Dream Deferred? And it's worth wondering what happens to a dreamer whose dream is deferred, which actually, I think, is actually everybody, because nobody is really who they imagined that they ought to be. So how do we find our happiness not with the fantasy self that we aspire to, but with the real self that we have and who we are and whom we have come to be? Mm.
So I know you're a professor. What do you love about teaching?
I love young people and their the way in which they are in the process of becoming themselves. There is a This must be Bobby Kennedy Day. Now I want to say vigor. There's a vigor in the young people. But yeah, these are people on the launch pad, and you can count down and watch the fires erupt from their rockets and stand there as they soar off into the sky, or help them to get to that point. I've been lucky enough to teach college students, so roughly 18 to 22-year-olds, sometimes a little older than that. And so these are people who are in the heart of becoming themselves, which in some ways sounds so delightful and so aspirational. But it's also true that it's an incredibly miserable time in your life, which older people forget just how miserable your 20s can be, because it's also a time in which you feel that you have to choose between various selves, and there are certain things that you have to let go of that you now cannot be, you cannot do. You realize you're never going to be on the Olympic fencing team. You realize that maybe you're a pretty good guitar player, but you're never going to be David Bowie. There's a very frustrating experience in which I think people, as they make choices, it also means it can mean not choosing other things. And I think that's what has happened to some of the characters in this novel, in fact, that they each make different choices. And the choices they make aren't necessarily bad ones, but they're haunted also by the things that they, by choosing other fates, are now unable to become.
Well, thank you so much, Jenny. This has been such a thrill.
Have we left any stone unturned?
I don't think so.
Oh, my God. We did it all.
Yes.
The ghosts did their work in a single night.
Exactly.
Well.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a gas, and I really appreciate being on the podcast. Oh. Sending everybody love.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening, readers. We have some reader questions on our site, in addition to a link to the creepy Spotify playlist that Abby put together to accompany Jennifer's book. It's the perfect background music for your meeting, or if you just want to scare yourself while you read.
And if you liked Long Black Veil and want to read more books like it, well, we've got your back, obviously. The Read It Forward team has suggested a few recommendations on readitforward.com/podcast.
We're producing monthly episodes centered on fantastic books we think you should read with your book club. So when you need something new, come see what we've been devouring recently.
And whether you're a subscriber of Book Club Appetizer or you're a first-time listener, we'd love to know what you think of our show. Take a minute and leave us a review on iTunes. We want to know, have you made any of the cocktails or appetizers? Have you listened to the playlists? Tell us everything.
And, as always, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, @ReadItForward, and tweet about books with us. Happy reading, and
cheers!